WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It's sometimes hard to know how to approach the customs of a culture that's very different from yours. For instance, it's fairly common for Americans to feel that initiation rites in other cultures are barbaric, or on the other hand, to romanticize primitive cultures as a pre-technological utopia where everything had a function and everyone knew their place. Well, coming up, we're going to hear about the Maasai in Africa. My guest is Tepelet Ole Saitoti, and he's the first educated Maasai warrior. The Maasai are a society on the Serengeti Plain of East Africa, near Kenya and Tanzania. You'd expect their elaborately plaited hair and body paint, detailed beadwork, and initiation ceremonies to attract, for instance, a National Geographic film crew, which it did. And when the film crew came, Saitoti, who was then a ranger in the Tanzania National Parks, became the subject of the film. The film, Man of Serengeti, was shot in 1971. He came to the United States to narrate the film and then stayed. He became a student and earned a BA in creative writing from Emerson College, then a master's of science degree in natural resources from the University of Michigan. He's now 31 and lives in Kenya, where he's engaged in conservation projects. But he's in America now on the occasion of the publication of his new book, Maasai, published by the art publisher Harry Abrams. This book features a text about the Maasai written by Saitoti, along with beautiful photographs by photographer Carol Beckwith. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you, Glenda.
Why did you initially leave the Maasai culture?
Right. To make a few corrections,
yeah,
way along the line.
Sure.
I'm 30 years old now.
Oh, okay.
And there's something else I wanted. I think I can't remember now. But anyway, we'll proceed.
Well, let me know if you think of it.
Okay. You asked,
why did you initially leave Maasai culture?
This was not my choice. My going to school changed me. At first, it was such a bitter experience to be taken away among so many of us. But one of us had to go, and it was me who was picked. And then I went to school, and I dare say it's a brainwashing process. Because when I reached the eighth grade, it was sort of a point of no return because I had this urge to want to continue with education. I failed, unfortunately. In East Africa, there's an intensive competition. But needless to say, there was that longing of wanting to go back to school. So I left. I was a warrior for quite a while, for 4 years, before I joined the Serengeti National Park. And then that very difficult moment came about that I really did want to go back to school. And there was no other way to really be admitted in a secondary educational level. In Africa, when the opportunity goes, it goes completely. There's intensive competition, very few schools. So I somehow predicted my future in many aspects. I say I better work as a ranger, and by so doing, I may meet people who I may impress them, and I may go back to school through them. And really, that's what happened. The most crucial moment, though, was to move away. My family is a very, very set, very not really powerful, but respected family in Maasai land. And the Maasai, as you people know, look down to other cultures, even the culture of a white man. So to anyone of my family to run away to go to work as a ranger, which is safe to, you went to work as a servant, was a very ridiculous move. I had to calculate days. I say that I can only look a job within 3 days. If I don't get it, I'll come back home so my parents will not know that I did try to run away. I kept on telling my father, please allow me to go. He goes, by you sending me to school, I've changed and I want to pursue. There's sort of a longing, a desire within me that I want to see the end of that education. My father kept on saying, let's wait for the rainy season. Let's wait for another. And the rainy season come and go. But later on, when I ran away and go back home, he told me, I'll never tell my son to go away from home to a culture which I do not know. The only culture I know is this culture which I made the best out of me. So it was a decision which you yourself had to make. So I made that decision. I joined the Serengeti National Park. And by sheer luck, the ball started rolling. In 4 years, I was picked as the character of this film. And it became a vehicle to where I am now.
Do you feel like you made the right decision in leaving?
That's a very good question. I don't know. The biggest question in my mind always say, who is lucky, me or my 49 brothers and sisters, whose life have been the same life of my forefathers? They're tracing it. They know their target, growing, longing to become a warrior, an elder, seeing children be born, married and have children, and increase their heads of cattle. Practically all of them now at that age, they're living their life fully. For me, I'm not yet settled. I'm still trying to adjust it to these two worlds I live in. But the truth is, I must also be practical. The Maasai way of life is changing. It's no longer a question whether will it change or not. It's in the process of changing. And because of that, if the Maasai way of life was not going to change, and it was just a comparison between my life and their life, I would say that I'm very unfortunate, because those people live their life fully from day to day. They have peace. It's not a cutthroat, intensive competition, which the Western world, which I seem to have chosen, have. But because the Maasai have to change, then I dare say that I'm lucky. Solely because that change is coming. It's earlier to change earlier than those who change behind. But so many a time I've wished that I was born 50 years ago or 50 years to come after this turning point has passed. But now, because I'm part and parcel of this turning page of history, of my race, I just have to face it boldly, and try to help them adjust it to this Western coming, or the 20th century, for that matter.
This kind of collision is happening in different parts of the world. In America, for instance, Eskimos are meeting up with Americans from California and New York who are going there to work on the pipeline, and their culture is getting changed in 2 years, say, by this collision with technology and with Americans. Do you think you can ever go back? Once a culture like yours has met up with Western culture, or once you as an individual has left Maasai land and gone somewhere else, can you ever return to that life?
There's no going back. It's like birth. A child never goes back to her mother's womb. When you are out, you are out. There's always this longing desire that I will always go to Maasai land, but I will always also go with an outsider whose other leg is on the other shore. Maasai land, as it seems now, is still a world, nicely and shapely, although it's changing. There's always a longing desire to go there, to be among my brothers and people who know me very well, and a longing of love. But it's quite impractical, to try and go back and live like a Maasai. It's a genesis. It's become a wishful thinking, a desire to go there and it's practically become religious, a pilgrimage, but one which you'll only be there very briefly, and off you go again. I have the longing desire that if I settle down and retire, that will be the countryside I would like to retire into. But life, I'm alternating, I belong to these two worlds. And it's a mere fact that they're part of me. I cannot really shed the Maasai world either. I'll live in these two worlds, and it's not an easy situation. The contrast is completely like day and night.
When you go back to visit your family, what do you wear? You're wearing a suit now.
Right.
What do you wear when you go back to visit?
Oh, usually I try to wear the most practical of clothes. For instance, sometimes if there's a big ceremony, I don't like to show to become conspicuous. I dress like a Maasai and participate fully in the ceremony, undertake. But then sometimes, I just put on practical clothes like jeans, or khaki shorts and so forth.
We tend to think of some things like boredom, alienation, neurosis, insecurity, feelings of inferiority as being psychological problems that occur in modern technological society. And many people think that if you go to a more primitive society, that you wouldn't find those problems. What do you think?
I agree. To give an example of Maasai land, there is really nothing of the sort, to speak the truth. I've even tried to you know, after being in America for 8 years and going back there and went through depression, anxiety and nervousness sometimes because of deadline in school and college and so forth, I went there, it's just incredible. There's plenty of time there. The sun hardly sets. So the pace is very slow. There's really maybe boredom if you are used to a very hectic life, but not depression. You know, you will never be depressed in Marseillan. Neurosis, we don't have any mental problems completely. It's really a sad phenomenon because sometimes I get very much disillusioned when I see the decay in urban centers of drugs, depression, insecurity, lack of confidence. Because the Maasai are a strong, very healthy society. And whenever I say, my God, my people had to change to this, to what? To this? You know, such a disillusionment now and then hit my mind, you know, and it makes me mad that they have to change. It's no longer their choice, you know, and all I wish if they can retain some of their culture. But really such things, completely, you can hardly, you can't find it.
You seem convinced that the culture is going to be affected or has even started being affected by modern technological society. What effects have already happened? What changes have already happened?
Well, you can see completely the impact of it as you go to areas of Marseillan which are close to urban centers or roads, you know. More so, Marseillan is having great national parks are located in Marseillan, which are a major attraction of tourists. And people always really wonder how the Maasai can resist it, because tourism can really ruin a culture, for that matter. They come with their cameras, photograph and things of that kind. And now and then you see Maasai standing even the roadside, practically being photographed, you know, because, you know, and charging money. And you can see there's decadence in a way, too. And, you know, they go to shops and they see their postcard, pictures of Maasai, beautiful girls, and they say they want to take these pictures to their children. And usually a shopkeeper will say, give me a shilling first before you take that postcard. And right away the Maasai starts saying, my God, so you're making money out of us. From now on, whenever you make a photograph out of me, you pay me first. You know, and it's completely, that's a very literal, I can see any human being doing that. And needless to say, the change of dress too, like in Kenya, which is more closely to the road, you'll see they have discarded their usual traditional dresses, such as leather skirts, while in Tanzania, which is still far more remote, they still have such habit. And nowadays, you see a lot of watches. You know, it's incredible. You know, you see watches and things of that kind. So you can see gradually that they're adapting. You see, if Marseillan was not going to be, were not going to lose land, they will change in their own pace. The most scary things, like what you said, what is happening to the Eskimos, is that pace that is coming so fast that they can't keep up with the speed. And the world regulates the speed rather than the Maasai. Any human being can adapt. But see, there's what you call a gradual progression. The Maasai would have that gradual, and they could really change and become a very healthy society while changing, if it is their pace. But if it's the pace dictated by outside, and then it's really dangerous, because the pace then comes practically overnight. And the Maasai now, that change is coming through losing their land, which is really their whole economical base.
Is that happening through the Tanzanian and Kenyan government?
More in Kenya, because there's a lot of land hunger in Kenya for other tribes. The space of land is, the Maasai still have a larger land than most of other tribes. And those other tribes really run the government. So they use bureaucratic technical knockout to rob the land from the Maasai. And the rate in which they're losing their land is very scary. If you are a concerned person like myself, so my God, the Maasai, this is the only things they have left. This is the only economical base. The only survival is this land, because they graze their cattle and they're very self-sufficient. But if that land go, they're not even prepared to work in light industry, which are growing in Kenya. You know, a lot of them are starting to work as security guards. The Maasai are known as brave warriors, really legendary people. And they never like to work as servants completely. You know, and needless to say that also it's a sort of a colonial inheritance. The British never really develop any light industries in Maasailand. For the obvious reason, they said the Lordly Maasai will never accept the position of servitude, which is true. Even the lodges now, which are being built in those national parks close to Maasailand, a Maasai can only work as a clerk. They don't want to work as waiters and things of that kind. So that's really a very, very big blow, because the pride is being met by extreme atrocity, you know, of change. So it can really shatter. The Maasai's future is, I'm sorry to say, is really dim.
Do you feel like there's anything that you can do to intercede or to slow things down a little bit?
Sometimes I wonder, I say, really, the book you have seen is a step forward toward to try to help my people. Sometimes I wonder, how can I affect the political process of Kenya and Tanzania? Because it's really a matter of retaining that land and the Maasai, you know. And sometimes I say, is it by joining politics? Or will I be part of the system and then I won't be able to criticize? Is it by starting a pastoral foundation, which is really what I'm thinking seriously? You know, just like this conservation movement, start a pastoral foundation. See, pastoralists are having it hard all over the world. No people, no government like nomads, even in Afghanistan, you name it, in the Sahel. And now they're having it harder in these years than ever before, because areas of grazing rotation they used to go during extreme dry seasons have been taken by agriculture or even by national parks. So now they are forced to deal only with rainy season grazing areas, and such areas cannot withstand intensive grazing during the dry season. So that's why you hear these crashes and so forth. So really thinking of internationalizing the issue, is it pastoral, is a civilization, a really healthy civilization, and it's the only civilization which completely can extract resources in the most arid of places, hostile places like the Sahara. Unless oil is discovered in a place like Sahara, that's when you hear people going there and extracting that oil. But before that, you know, only camels and, you know, harsh environment like the north frontier of Kenya, only herders can extract with their animals the little grass which can be found in those areas. So to eat or die is a blow to humanity. It's an economical blow and it's a cultural blow. So really, it's something which should be protected.
Let me just reintroduce you for our listeners who are just tuning in now. My guest is Ole Saitoti, who is he was born a Maasai, and he's the first Maasai warrior to...
Yes, I'm sorry, that was the mistake. I'm just among the first Maasais who have gone to school, but I'm not the first. The few Maasais, some are doctors now, who are working and so forth, but I'm just among the first, particularly in my area, in that particular area, which is the Serengeti Plain. Yeah.
Okay, so I stand corrected on that. Now, he came to America and received a BA in and an MA at American universities, is now living in Kenya where he's working on conservation projects. I'd like to talk a little bit, I just want to mention the book that he's written again, too. It's called Maasai, and it's a very large, beautiful book with photographs of the culture in it as well, and it's published by the art publisher Harry Abrams. Let's talk a little bit about Maasai culture.
Right.
Now, you say in your book that two of the most important values, two of the most important things within the culture are cattle and children. Can you explain that for us?
Right. It's true. The children are sort of, you cannot separate children and cattle because there's child labor in Maasailand. Children are the ones who go to look after cattle. And definitely, usually when you have children, you're likely to have a larger herd of cattle. And there's no reason to have children when you don't have an economical base to see to it that they survive and live life fully, you know. So you cannot, the two are inseparable. So usually whenever Maasai meets, you say, how are the children, how are the cattle? It's practically like a greeting. And the last blessing, have children, have cattle, you know. So you can just see the importance of the two.
Can you describe family life for us?
Family life is very strong family closeness. Take an example of myself. We are 50 children in my father now, and we really are close completely. You know, we know one another's habits, you know, and things of that kind, and you see to it that you don't upset. If you know that a person is weaker in this particular point, you never meet him in that angle because you are likely to upset him, you know. And we are it's a very, very healthy family. There's extremely strong attachment. If I quarreled when I was a kid, my mother spanked me, I'll dash off to one of my father's wife and make sure not to come there until my mother come begging. So, you know, things like that. It's a strong, and usually fathers, of course, have to be a strong person, an overseer of the family to bring the family together. It was, you know, for a larger family like that, it's a dynamic difference. But, you know, people have yet to still tolerate one another.
No, it's polygamous. Men have a number of wives.
Right, yeah.
How does that work? What kind of relationship do the wives have to one another, and how much time do they each spend with,
well,
with
usually
their one husband?
Each woman had to have her own house, so there's always that independent privacy of one having her own house with her own children. And, you know, they are guiding laws, you know, which protect the woman's interest or even the man's interest. And if a man abused those, you know, those laws, definitely the woman will report the matter to her parents, who will report it to the elders. And definitely the elders will hold a meeting and see that guy is in his proper perspective. But at the same time, sometimes you'll find a man loving one wife more. They're just like any human being. Maybe that woman loves him more, you know. But that should, he should not exceedingly favor her, because there are law guiding. For instance, he have to have contact with every wife. Completely. Whenever wives want him, he must be there.
What if, say, two wives want him at the same time?
No, usually there's an adjustment. Say, you know, I couldn't come, you know, definitely. But definitely you have to rotate, you know, according to the family itself.
Now, women have,
but women have lovers.
Have lovers, right?
Oh, yeah, women have lovers, too.
Now, how
so,
does that
know,
work?
Sometimes, you know, if you don't like your husband, you don't necessarily want to call him a lot, because, you know, you'll have the most freedom to see whoever you like most. You know, so it's quite tolerated. It's a very, there are Maasai moral laws, you know, which as long as you don't break them, definitely you are allowed to, you know, to live. But the Maasai exploit pride very, very much. They always say, my God, don't play yourself cheap. In case you get a child from that man, it should be a healthy mental child. Don't just throw yourself to whoever, you know, because, and really Maasai women are just incredible. They're ladies in the outermost. They carry themselves high, and, you know. And it's a very sophisticated society. Practically every law is very practical, you know. There's no confusion.
Give us some examples of practical laws.
Well, you know, we have generation. Really, that's, you know, like you have a generation. Each generation have a name. If, for instance, I'm married now, our generation, my woman can have lovers from my generation only, not below the generation below us, because that will be counted an incest. He can, and then there are technicality as well of, he can also have relationship with guys above us, but not those after the one above us. So, you know, there's progression like that, and you have to follow those guidelines. If you don't follow those guidelines, practically you'll be put in place. If you are caught, then you are being put in place.
What's the punishment?
Oh, it varies, depending on the court decision by elders. Although most Maasai laws have already, before you do even a crime, you already know what will be the fine, you know, usually.
What kind of fine, though, might it be?
For instance, if a kid steal a goat, you'll pay a 2-year-old calf. Warriors steal an oxen to slaughter, you'll pay five cows. If you take a pregnant cow now, you'll have to pay 5 cows and half of the 5 cows, because there is another life within the cow. So, you know, and definitely there are laws. You have to use your clan members to check Maasai constitutional laws, you know, for that matter. So usually when you know that you have committed a crime, you go to one of your clan's known orator and wise elder. And usually the other side will also do the same. And then there's a clash of these very, very wise men, you know, try to check Maasai laws. And usually the meeting will be open to the public or to any participant. And then it's judged when they see that one is guilty. The consensus is found. And the guilty one, you know, the one who is guilty become obvious. So the punish, you know, the leader of the generation usually sum up the situation, and the fine is decided.
So yeah. What kind of fine might there be if a woman has relations with someone below the age that she's supposed
sometimes
to?
Sometimes it becomes a fiscal punishment. If you do below, that's incest. Women can punish you. Women are the one who deal with incest laws, really. But if you're a warrior if a warrior is caught doing that, he have to pay a heifer to the own, you know, to the man's wife, and bring a bag of tobacco, and he will be reprimanded, and it may affect him during the time when he gets married, because that elder can come and curse him out, can come and say, how can you marry my daughter of this generation when you have fooled around with their mothers? You cannot marry the mother, you cannot make love to the mother and marry the daughters. Right. You know, it doesn't have to be direct that particular daughter, but the daughter of that particular generation covers, you know, it's regarded completely as a daughter. So you have to, which, my God, first of all, the exposure is an embarrassment. It can affect your marriage life. You know, you are no longer respectful to the generation of those above you. And it's really respect which guides my silence, that respect between generation.
Can you describe the initiation ceremony to us that a young boy will go through before becoming a Maasai warrior?
Usually the there are stages, like first of all, you have to go through ear piercing at about 13, and then it's the circumcision. Sometimes people take it wrongly that every Maasai must kill a lion before his, but it's not it's not a must. It's good to kill a lion because they are our natural enemies. Being predators, they attack our herds. That's like saving children and cattle. So usually, you know, you make a name if you kill a lion, so the warriors long to do that. But it's not mandatory, or else there would be no lion. And then it's really initiation, which is more spiritual and mental than the physical act. The physical oppression become really just a symbolic. You know, it's the right, the rite of passage. You are now a man.
Well, something that Westerners usually dwell on in ceremonies like that is the circumcision, because you've got someone who's, how old, 12 or 13, maybe getting circumcised, which must be extremely painful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is that experience like? Is it something that's dreaded by the young boys? Is it extremely painful?
No, it's something you long for. You beg your father to be initiated, to be a man. Because no matter how old you are and circumcised, you are not counted as a... You'll never make any decision. You are completely... Your whole life is still under your parents. You are treated like a child. You are always receiving and not giving. And then, you know, circumcision become like a rite of passage, an endorsement that you are now a man or a woman. You are not expected to receive, but to give. The symbolic pain you have withstand before us all will demonstrate, you know, will be symbolic that will take it that you'll also face the challenges and the pains of life the way you just face those pains. So it's more spiritual than Western usually take that very, very wrongly, because in reality, it's just an endorsement, completely a period in time where a child is told you are now a man. You have to make a decision. And if you see children of the same age in Maasai land, be it a girl or a boy, the same age, or even one older but not initiated, and the one who is initiated, just because of that mental that you are now expected by the, you know, you are now a man or a woman, there's a very big difference. The one who is circumcised is always very, very responsible than the one who is not circumcised. Completely.
Now, for women, the circumcision is what's called a clitoridectomy. It's the removal of the clitoris and other tissue inside, well, around the vaginal area. That also seems like a horrifyingly painful kind of thing to go through. How do the young girls react to that?
You see, many African people, and maybe even Islamic, we never do that as the Western view it. It's to suppress a woman's sexuality completely. We are doing circumcision just the way we do it to a boy. How can you separate your children? If you can do it to a boy, you must also do it to... If a man must be a man, a woman also must be a woman. A woman must also know the pains of life. It's completely a symbolic issue. If unknowingly we affect maybe the sexual of a woman, that happened without our knowledge. The Maasai don't know that they're doing that as to suppress women's sexuality. And needless to say, I really don't think it even suppresses, because, my God, I've had experience of both Western women and the Maasai women. I haven't found it different yet so far.
That's actually very interesting, because to Western women, I hope this isn't getting too personal for you, but to Western women, the clitoris is like the main part of sexual pleasure. And to a Western person to think of removing that, one would think that you would be preventing a woman from experiencing complete sexual pleasure, and that therefore many people regard it as a way to deprive women of having sexual pleasure.
Many Africans don't do that for that reason at all. That's completely a Western imposition. It's never completely to our knowledge that we do that for that reason. And seeing a Maasai who's initiated and a woman, Maasai woman who's not initiated, I've happened to have, you know, affairs with them. I've never seen the difference. Neither with the Western women whom I've had affairs with and the Maasai women. Maasai women are just as romantic as any other Western women completely. And there's that urge and the pleasure is there. But there are women who do not sometimes come or take a longer time and so forth. Same thing applied to Maasai women, like anywhere in the world. So I've really never seen experience of a problem. And I don't even know how much of the tissue is really removed, for that matter. Maybe the exposed, because sometimes I think the clitoris is a nerve, which you go deeper than just the above thing. I think it's completely attached to your whole nerve system, you know. I don't think by removing that little thing, you have cut that nerve completely. I think the nerve is still there, you know, or the root of that nerve are still attached far to your brain, you know. Maybe if you probably cut a spinal cord and remove the whole abdomen. But I think that nerve go deeper than that.
I know that anthropologists have been debating whether they should... that some Westerners have actually been debating whether they should intervene in these initiation rites, which are in Western culture sometimes called genital mutilation, and whether it's projecting onto a society your own feelings about your body, and whether it's fair to pass judgment on something like that. And I guess you would say that
it's completely unfair. In fact, first of all, to use such strong languages like that, it's practically sacrilegious, more so when it's not your culture. What do you know of that culture? What are they feeling? They never... Usually these people sensationalize the things they don't do themselves. You know, it's the same justification of colonialism. If a white man did not know the religion of this other guy, he called it heathenicist, you know, just because it's not either Muslim or Christian, to a point which they would even have dared to call Islamic atheist, as long as they don't conform to Christian faith or whatever. So there's a lot of issues there which have a lot of colonial justification, or, you know, or guilty consciousness justification. It's incredible. So completely I would oppose that. And even you go as far as even challenging the anthropology subject itself. What right do they have to study other races of men? What right do you have to impose on another race of a person that society have multiplied, they have prospered through time? Because, you know, they're living, there's certain guideline which made that society be or exist. Well, and what right do you have to come and impose you as solely because they don't conform to what you do? I think that's extremely unfair. And to use strong languages like that, genital mutilation, when those people can still produce children and things of that kind. If you are mutilated, then you don't produce. But Maasai, you know, it's ridiculous. It's completely unfair.
Let's talk a little bit about how boys' and girls' lives are changed once they become adults after the initiation ceremony. Mm-hmm. Let me just reintroduce you again first. I'm talking with Ole Saitoti, who is a Maasai who has received a BA and an MA from American universities and now is living in Kenya working on conservation projects. What is the life of a Maasai warrior like after the initiation, when the person is an adult and a warrior? The word warrior makes it seem like they're always out fighting wars.
No, I think the Maasai themselves call it Moran, which I wouldn't know the literal translation in English. Okay, those who speak English have always labeled the Maasai as warriors. Maybe that even carried a very negative connotation. A Moran, or a warrior, usually a stage in which the highest moment of a Maasai man, the Maasai exploit that explosive energy from 18 to 19 to 20. You know, youth really have a lot of excess of energy. So you divert that excess of energy to be constructive with the society as a whole. You know, okay, you say you are strong, all right. Become warriors, protect the Maasai land from invaders. You know, kids start paying more attention to their outlook. You know, it's the a prime period of one's life, you know. You start being more conscious of how you look. You go further to attract women and things of that kind. So you give this kid, you give them freedom to do that, the freedom of sex, you know, freedom to defend myself. And you expect so much from these guys. And, you know, when you give human being potential, people, human beings have got potential. When you give them confidence, they really usually try to, you know, to meet those expectations of the society. For instance, if a rhino charges through a crowd, they say, what are the warriors? You know, that's how the society respects you. If a bull have to be wrestled, to be tied, you know, to be branded or even slaughtered or have a belt tied on its neck, what are the warriors? You know, whenever there's a fiscal action, which they say, what are the warriors? And my God, if you give children at that age, you know, when you really... You sort of respect, you know that they've got the energy, the strength, and you respect that they really do have, they really always try to meet such expectation. And you'll be surprised, Maasai hardly fall short of it completely, whatever the society expects of them. And so, the pride take over the whole being is just incredible.
So this period is for what age are you a warrior?
Usually from 18 to 35, but see, it's starting to change. The Maasai warriors are like a Maasai standing army, really. We used to have a continuous cattle raids in Africa and war between other tribes. So you have warriors to defend Maasai land. And nowadays, the government is finding very, very difficult because there's continuous cattle raid even up to now. Kenya and Tanzania have a strong stock safety unit, police force, which only deal with cattle raiding between tribes. The Maasai cattle are also raided by that tribe, and the Maasais are very well organized. So usually, they are far more effective because of that warrior grouping, you know, these warrior sections, grouping and so forth. So they're usually very effective. So nowadays the government has shortened the period of Maasai warrior to become warriors practically. Instead of from 18 to 35, you see a lot of kids graduating at 26 nowadays because of the government pressure. Solely because at that time, warriors are allowed to judge things fiscally. If the cattle raid, they're going to raid. If cattle have been raided, they follow it and retrieve them back, you know. But then there's continuous trouble with the government. And even the government police really find it difficult to go to Maasai land, you know, because the Maasais are very well organized at war and they're very, very brave. So the government nowadays use chiefs to try to speed up the period in which warriors should remain warriors, which is sad in a way.
You mentioned in your book that the Maasai believe that all cattle belong to the Maasai, and that's maybe part of the reason for the raids.
Right. Yeah, because the Maasai legend, well, it's now more a legend than a reality. He used to say God once had only three children. One he gave a stick to be a herder, which is the Maasai. One he gave a digging stick to be a farmer or to cultivate, to till the soil. And then one he gave an arrow and a bow to be a hunter. So the Maasai say these people must have taken the cattle away from us. If this is the lineage, the way God have created, why should they have cattle? So bring those cattle back.
Now, after being a Maasai, there's another, after being a warrior, there's another initiation ceremony and a man becomes an elder. Now, what's life like for an elder?
An elder, you know, usually when you're in the elderhood, there's a lot of responsibility too. It's only that you'll see when warriors are retiring, they really cry a lot. They don't want to become elders. Their comradeship, which is they usually work together, share practically everything together. Now they have to become individual, but very responsible. You know, they are told to use the art of the tongue and the wisdom of the mind, you know, to decide, to make decisions, rather than the usual fiscal decision, which warriors are allowed to do. At that particular age, no. They must carry Maasai culture now. They must use their mind. They must not carry weapons. You know, they are no longer allowed to be fiscal.
They also have their head shaved during the ceremony. What does that mean? Something?
Yeah, only warriors are allowed to keep long hair. Women and what? But it really doesn't. It's just a symbolic which defines those categories. You know, if you don't even have time to pay attention to those hair, which warriors have time, you become more responsible to look care of your family. And it's more, if you don't take care of the hair, you might as well be, it is more hygienic if you shave them rather than to have them and then, you know, take care of them. Otherwise, the lice will feed, you know, will fill them.
When you say taking care of the hair, the young man's hair is very elaborately plaited.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They'll continuously take care of those hair. And it's a very expensive undertaking, just like the one in the West. Like sometime when warriors go in a slaughtering camp, in a retreat, you know, and usually what they do, each one contribute a bullock or an oxen. But then those warriors will not braid their hair, as long as he will braid all the others' hair, and then he's not allowed, he doesn't have to contribute. So you can imagine how expensive, it's just an expensive adventure, you know. So during that time, they allow, they have all the time to do that. But when you become an elder, you become extremely responsible with your own family. You have to increase the head to see that, you know, getting married, and so you no longer have that time. So that's why you have to shave your head as a, yeah.
How have you taken the Americans plaiting their hair? Both black and white Americans have been plaiting their hair.
Yeah, but what I don't understand, they call it French rolls. Those are our hair roll, you know. We have been braiding hair for billions of years, you know, if I can say, you know. The Maasai very much resemble Egyptian, even the hair formation and things of that kind.
I haven't heard the word French. Cornrows is the expression I usually hear.
Yeah, cornrow. Yeah. Cornrow or French cornrow.
I haven't heard the French part, but...
Yeah. But anyways, they're really African, the braiding hair. But usually, only men braid hair, not women, in the African scene. In Maasai land. But right. In the African scene, it's a different case altogether because they're... Very, there are dynamic and differences, big differences between other tribes in Africa.
When a man goes through the initial initiation ceremony, he leaves the boyhood and becomes a man,
right.
And can become a warrior. Right. When a woman goes through an initiation ceremony, what changes occur in her life?
You become a woman, ready to bear children,
mm-hmm.
And you get married.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Maasai culture. You know, you have been living in America for a while,
right.
And then moved back to Kenya.
Right.
What surprised you about American culture? What was difficult for you to understand? What seemed weird or bizarre to you about life here?
Well, it's not much a thing because the whole world has become uniform. There's a lot of... commonness, the British are in Kenya, and definitely many Africans have changed. Millions of them have changed. I was astounded when I first came to Germany to see big cities like that. You know, I've never known that we were a minority. I've always thought black people have a majority in the world. I felt out of place when I first came to a place where I was, you know, I was a minority because I've never known that we were a minority. We are probably really not, but I've never been in a place where I was a minority. That was really shocking, you know, to see that there were so many white people. I never anticipated. I've always been a minority where I grew up. And, well, it's different, you know. You'll go to a hotel and you see a menu. You really don't know what will come. You know how to read, it's a hamburger or something like that, but I didn't know that. It was a very classic joke when the Maasai came here, and he was being introduced in the campus, and they say, help yourself, there's hot dogs there, and he say, I don't eat a dog either cold or hot, because he thought it was dog meat. So you can just imagine, those, you know, such a little thing, but yet they can really be shocked, because you didn't know what it meant. And the menu was really a blow, too. Oh, Subway, there's a strong, like in New York, you take a Subway, there's a strong hostility to a point in which I say, my God, these people, like, they've declared a war, although they're not talking. They're sort of guessing at one another. You know, Africans talk a lot, you know, they're friendly, either the weather or what, you know. I saw that hostility, you know, the intense, the urban, you know, sort of territorial imperative, don't you touch my shoulder, what, you know. That is a bit scary.
Did you have to learn how to walk differently and how to? Because I mean, everyone agrees that you've got to on tough streets. You have to walk with a certain assuredness so that no one hassles you.
Right. I remember when I first came to New York, I had to grow a beard, and I had to dress up like, you know, blue jeans and rough. I don't comb my hair because I was afraid that I may be mocked, and I never knew what would be my response. So I say I better be people should be scared of me, you know. So if a mugger see me, he won't mug me because he think I may mug him. So things like that, you know, I sort of, you know. And funny enough, I think the walking is still with me, the Maasai walking. Just before, when I was coming here, I was walking down the street, and this lady say, "Are you from Ghana?" I say, "My God, I'm dressed like an American executive or Western man. So how do you know that?" It practically scared me. And I say, "Oh, I just sort of, the way you walk." And that was really, so I still think I still walk like a Maasai. In a way, I had the pleasure. I was sort of happy that my culture is still with me. But yet at the same time, scary because I don't want to be too conspicuous either in a foreign society. Maybe I'll become vulnerable, you know, things of that kind.
Do you feel a rapport with American blacks, or is there a strong cultural difference since you grew up in such a different society than most of the blacks in America did?
It's true. We are different. They're Americans and we are Africans. Africans are strong basic culture, very conservative society. You know, they're very, we are different, yet there's a strong sympathy, you know, which we share, definitely. My God, we share the same common oppression. There's black people, colored people all over the world have been abused, either by fate or history, at least. So there's that strong bondage. But usually there's a lack of communication. Sometimes when I find very well-educated people, then I really understand them. But usually street people, I find it very, very difficult, as much as I really want to. There's lack of communication. When I first came here, I had a very hard time with the accent. I couldn't, you know, and they didn't understand me either, you know. Needless to say, I worked very hard, and I avoided campus politics, you know. A black student don't want you to associate with white, and one white wanted to push you in that. So what I did, I just sort of, you know, I say I'm an African getting an education here, working hard. I'll participate wherever I think I fit in. And again, why should I gamble with American politics? These are not, so I was able to really remove myself from their politics, but I shared socially, you know, with any group I thought I could fit in well, and those who opened their hands to me, you know, right?
So what are your plans now?
I intend to maybe stay in L.A. and San Francisco for a year. And soon after, I will go home. I will never live away from home exceeding 2 years. That has been completely my decision. Because usually it's a little bit hard to adjust when you go back after such long periods of time, like 4 years and so forth. So that's what I intend to do next.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. And it's really been a terrific experience meeting you and speaking with you. Thanks very much for coming this afternoon.
Thank you, Deb.